Hello, this is Sean Lazar, and I'm going to be reading from my book, The Myth of Tithing and the Joy of Grace Giving. In this episode, I'm going to be reading from Chapter 4, entitled Giving and the Heart. 4.1 Introduction. If you've ever traveled internationally, you probably had to walk through a duty-free shopping store where luxury goods like jewelry, whiskey, and chocolates were sold free of import taxes. You might have even walked through one of the stores owned by Duty Free Shoppers, or DFS, co-founded by Charles Feeney in 1960. Over time, the company grew to have hundreds of millions of dollars in sales. By 1996, it was sold for over $1 billion, making Feeney a very wealthy man. Or it almost did. You see, it turned out that Feeney didn't own any shares in DFS, at least not anymore. Years earlier, he had started Atlantic Philanthropies and secretly transferred all of his shares to it. So when DFS was sold, the philanthropy got all the money, and through careful investing, it grew into billions of dollars. And for the rest of his life, Feeney slowly, secretly, and anonymously gave away the entire fortune. It is estimated that Feeney gave away over $8 billion. He paid for the construction of over 1,000 buildings on 5 continents, and not a single one bears his name. Just as striking, in his personal life, Feeney was extremely frugal. He never owned a car or a home. He flew coach, and he carried his reading materials in a plastic bag. Whatever else you might say about him, Feeney clearly had a very different attitude towards money than do most people in the world. The same should be true of grace believers. We've looked at several grace-giving principles that make it very different from the popular teaching about tithing. The overarching truth is that, under grace, you can give however much you have purposed in your heart. But that raises the crucial question. What's in your heart? Does it have the right priorities? Is it in the right place? If your heart is full of sin, greed, and covetousness, your giving will suffer. If you want to excel at grace-giving, you need to dig deeper into matters of the heart. And Jesus' teaching about giving does just that. Section 4.2, Where Your Heart Is. Sin has a way of trapping you before you realize it. F. Scott Fitzgerald famously said, "First you take a drink, then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes you." In other words, the occasional sin can escalate into a persistent habit, which then festers into an addiction. Greed is no exception. Jesus knew how alluring and addictive money could be. Whenever your heart is addicted to something, you'll think about it obsessively. Your dreams, plans, and goals will center around getting more of it. And the more you get, the more you'll want. Jesus knew that money could capture our interests like few other things, which then creates a problem for discipleship. As the Lord warned, quote, "Don't store up for yourselves treasure on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves don't break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also," end quote. Matthew 6:19-21. In this passage, Jesus taught his disciples to change their mindsets, their heart attitudes about money. He assumes our hearts will always be focused on treasure somewhere. The only question is where? Will your heart be focused on treasure on earth or in heaven? Notice that desiring treasures is not intrinsically wrong. The Lord is not against saving and investments per se, so long as it is heavenly. Of course, you'll be tempted to focus on building up earthly wealth. You need to fight that temptation. But how? One way is to change your thinking about how to value earthly wealth. In this passage, Jesus gives us several reasons for thinking we have overvalued earthly wealth, earthly treasure. First, earthly treasure can be destroyed. Wealth isn't something you can depend upon. For example, 3 weeks ago, I was vacationing at a friend's cabin in Ruidoso, New Mexico, and I thought about how wonderful it would be to live there or to have a vacation home there. I thought the owner of the cabin was so lucky. And then, a week later, the cabin burned in a fire that devastated the entire village, destroying hundreds of homes and buildings. It had burned right down to the foundations. Second, you can lose your treasure. It's estimated that the ocean floors are littered with billions of dollars worth of treasure. More recently, a British man accidentally threw out a hard drive with over $270 million worth of Bitcoin. You're not guaranteed to have it forever. Third, and even more commonly, earthly treasure can be stolen. Thieves can rob you, con men can swindle you, or the government can devalue the currency and therefore your savings. So far, I have lived through three recessions that destroyed the finances of untold numbers of people. No earthly treasure is safe from theft. Now, each of Jesus' reasons should help change your attitude about finances. When you keep those considerations in mind, you'll not value earthly treasure so highly. By contrast, Jesus challenges us to think more deeply about the importance of investing in heavenly treasure, which evidently lasts forever and cannot be destroyed, lost, or stolen. Although the Lord doesn't clearly explain what the treasure is, and commentators disagree about how literally to take it, the Lord is communicating that heavenly treasure is far more desirable than anything we could accumulate on earth. You may not fully understand what that means, but if you have trusted the Lord with your salvation, you should also trust Him in this. Heavenly treasure is better than earthly treasure. In other words, disciples should train their hearts to take an eternal perspective on treasure. What can you do if you struggle with the sin of greed and find your mind filled with tempting thoughts of hoarding earthly treasure? It isn't enough to say no to those temptations. You need to fight them by building up the corresponding virtue. The more you have the virtue, the less tempting the sin will be. For example, replace your old thoughts about earthly wealth with thoughts about gaining heavenly treasure or rewards. When you become convinced the latter are more valuable than the former, your heart will not be so tempted by them. Section 4.3, Serving God or Mammon. In his famous work, Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville, sorry, I had to say that in the French way, observed that Americans are especially concerned with earthly treasure. I know of no country, indeed, where the love of money has taken stronger hold on the affections of men, and where profounder contempt is expressed for the theory of the permanent equality of property. But wealth circulates with inconceivable rapidity, and experience shows that it is rare to find two succeeding generations in the full enjoyment of it. End quote. The heart seems forced to choose between earthly and heavenly treasures. Elsewhere, Jesus confirmed that money is a binary heart issue that rises to the level of idolatry. Quote, "No one can serve two masters, since either he will hate one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." End quote. Matthew 6:24. When it comes to God and money, you probably want to have your cake and eat it too. You may think you can compromise and find a way of loving both in a healthy way, but according to Jesus, that's impossible. You can't balance your loyalties between God and money. The choice is always binary. You'll either love God and hate money, or love money and hate God. It's always one or the other. Obviously, Christians should be dedicated to God alone. We're commanded to love God with all our hearts, mind, soul, and strength, which excludes loving money. If your heart is ensnared by the almighty dollar and mammon is your idol, that will affect your giving. After all, you probably won't want to give away the thing you serve and prize above all else. Thus, to be a good giver, you must choose to serve God over mammon. And when you do, you can begin to see money for what it is, a tool to be used in Christian service. When God is your master, money will be your servant. Section 4.4. Concern with money can make you unfruitful. An idolatrous focus on money will obviously impact your walk of faith for the worse. But Jesus also warned about less obvious ways in which having the wrong perspective on earthly treasure can hinder discipleship. In the parable of the four soils, a sower casts seed in a field. Some seed fell on thorny ground, and while a plant grew, it never became fruitful. There was a tomato plant, but no tomatoes. Why not? Jesus explains, quote, "Now the one sown among the thorns, this is one who hears the word, but the worries of this age and the deceitfulness of wealth choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful." End quote. Matthew 13:22. Jesus says the thorns represent worries and the deceitfulness of wealth. Both can stop you from being fruitful. What are the worries of this age? Well, they certainly include worrying about money and everything related to it, such as paying for insurance, mortgage, and fixing your car. If your heart is set on your investment accounts and you know how unstable the economy is, you'll constantly be thinking about them and so preoccupied with maintaining or gaining even more wealth. You'll put off serving the Lord to seek after mammon. How is wealth deceitful? Well, one way is that it promises earthly security and power when the reality is that it can be destroyed, lost, or stolen in a heartbeat. It promises comforts it cannot deliver on, especially in light of eternity. So don't let the thorns of worry and wealth choke your Christian fruitfulness. Section 4.5. Lay up treasure by seeking the kingdom. Instead of focusing your life on acquiring earthly treasure, Jesus calls you to seek something better. The Lord said, quote, "But seek his kingdom, and these things will be provided for you. Don't be afraid, little flock, because your Father delights to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Make money bags for yourselves that won't grow old, an inexhaustible treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." End quote. Luke 12, verses 31 to 34. Here again, Jesus encourages disciples to seek heavenly treasure. Over the years, I've met Christians who are skeptical about that motivation. They think we should only serve God disinterestedly without being motivated by eternal rewards. They consider rewards to be selfish. While I understand that criticism, I think it's a mistake. Jesus told us to seek the kingdom and to make money bags that won't grow old. He urged us to store up, quote, "an inexhaustible treasure in heaven." That's not a motivation Jesus discourages or calls sinful, but something he expects us to value and to prioritize. Whatever that treasure represents, we should value it more than earthly treasure. If someone thinks that's selfish, well, they should repent and bring their standards in line with Jesus' teaching. The Lord wants you to desire heavenly treasure. Not desiring it is wrong. Seeking the kingdom is not selfish so much as self-interested. It's a godly self-interest that is encouraged by Jesus himself. Section 4.6. Greed is foolish. Throughout his ministry, people asked Jesus about money. The topic seems to have come up often. For example, one day, a man asked Jesus for help with his inheritance. Quote, "Someone from the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." "Friend," he said to him, "who appointed me a judge or arbitrator over you?" He then told them, "Watch out and be on guard against all greed, because one's life is not in the abundance of his possessions." End quote. Luke 12, 13 to 15. This man's parents had died and left an inheritance to him and his brother. But they were quarreling over who got what. When one of the brothers asked Jesus to settle the matter, rather than get dragged into acting as their arbitrator, Jesus discerned a deeper problem: greed. Sometimes a perfectly legal request can be motivated by a hidden sin, making it sinful to do. In this case, Jesus discerned that the brother was asking for help out of greed. It's safe to say that we've all acted out of greed. How should we respond to that kind of temptation? Jesus says we should watch out and be on guard. Indeed, those became the two watchwords of Christian spirituality for centuries. To watch out, horao, literally refers to seeing with your eyes, but came to mean spiritually discerning something. Pay close attention and watch out for the temptations and thoughts that will come to you, identifying them for what they are and being sure to reject them. To guard, philosso, is to have uninterrupted vigilance. In other words, we guard our hearts, our thoughts and motivations, always looking to discern the evil suggestions that come our way. The fact is, being greedy is foolish or short-sighted. To illustrate what he meant, Jesus told this parable. Quote, "A rich man's land was very productive. He thought to himself, 'What should I do since I don't have anywhere to store my crops?' 'I'll do this,' he said. 'I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones and store all my grain and my goods there. Then I'll say to myself, you have many goods stored up for many years. Take it easy. Eat, drink, and enjoy yourself.' But God said to him, 'You fool. This very night your life is demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? That's how it is with the one who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. End quote. Luke chapter 12, verses 16 to 21. The rich man spent his life hoarding goods, planning for a comfortable future he would never enjoy. After he died unexpectedly, his hard-earned wealth went to other people, making his lifelong selfishness a waste. Worse, the man died without being, quote, rich towards God, meaning there was no treasure waiting for him in heaven. What this parable shows is that greed is not only sinful, it's also irrational. It prioritizes short-term comforts over eternal benefits. The spiritually mature mind recognizes that this world is passing away and prioritizes using money to serve God rather than one's own selfish desires. Section 4.7, Making Friends with Money. Jesus taught us another positive way to use our money. Although you shouldn't love it, be devoted to it, or serve it, money is helpful for ministry. For example, Jesus told an odd parable known as the parable of the dishonest manager. In that story, a wealthy man hears that his steward has mismanaged his estate and demands an audit. The steward knows that he's guilty and will lose his job, so he takes action to make sure he at least has a soft landing. He goes to the clients who owe his boss large sums of money, renegotiates their contracts, and reduces what they owe. We're not told why he does that, but we can imagine it was to make the debtors grateful to him so they would owe him a favor, such as giving him a place to live. When the rich man finds out what happened, he praises the steward for at least being shrewd. Here's Jesus' application. Quote, "And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of worldly wealth, so that when it fails, they may welcome you into eternal dwellings. Whoever is faithful in very little is also faithful in much, and whoever is unrighteous in very little is also unrighteous in much. So if you have not been faithful with worldly wealth, who will trust you with what is genuine? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to someone else, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, since either he will hate one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money," end quote. Luke 19, verses 9 to 13. Here are some lessons Jesus expects us to draw from the parable. First, we should make friends with worldly wealth so they'll welcome us into eternal dwellings. What does that mean? The unjust steward evidently hoped that he'd be given hospitality by the debtors he had helped. By analogy, Jesus might mean you can use your wealth to win souls so those people will welcome you in eternity. Won't that be amazing? Second, if you're faithful with worldly wealth now, you'll be trusted with much and genuine heavenly treasure later. If you use your earthly treasure in the service of the kingdom, it will impact your heavenly wealth later. In other words, you'll have greater eternal rewards. Third, Jesus contrasts loyalty to God and loyalty to money. You can't serve both and you can't love both. The heart's choice is always binary. Love one and hate the other, serve one or serve the other. The spiritual mature approach is to use money for the sake of the gospel so as to make eternal friends for yourself. Section 4.8, Jesus will reward your works. We've mentioned the idea of heavenly treasure and rewards and what place those should have in a renewed attitude towards wealth, and it may be time to explain them a little more. Christians have long noted that the New Testament refers to eternal rewards, but generally speaking, the doctrine of rewards was not developed until after the Reformation. Once Paul's doctrine of justification by faith apart from works was recovered from centuries of work salvation tradition, and it became clear once again that salvation is a gift given through faith apart from works, see Galatians 2:16 or Ephesians 2:8-9, commentators could then see there was a biblical distinction between salvation and rewards. Unlike salvation, heavenly treasures are earned as payment for the works that you do for the Lord. If you believe in Jesus, you'll never come under judgment for your eternal destiny. That issue was settled the moment you believed in him, see John 5:24. However, you will still appear before the Lord to have your life evaluated. That day will not be about proving your salvation, but about assessing your faithfulness. That's why Jesus spoke about storing up treasure in heaven. He was referring to rewards given on the basis of what we've done for him. Since not all Christians are equally faithful, some lay up more treasure than others. As an illustration, do you remember the story of the three little pigs? Each one built a house. The ones that used straw and sticks did it faster and had more time to play after. It took longer for the pig who built his house out of bricks. However, all that hard work paid off when a big bad wolf came to town and was able to blow down the first two cheaply built houses and not the house of bricks. The fable taught children that the easy route might result in immediate gratification, but only hard work pays off in the long run. Paul used a similar illustration to teach the Corinthians about rewards. He compared living the Christian life to building a house, i.e., the body of Christ. Quote, "For no one can lay any foundation other than what has been laid down. That foundation is Jesus Christ. If anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, each one's work will become obvious, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire. The fire will test the quality of each one's work. If anyone's work that he has built survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will experience loss, but he himself will be saved, but only as through fire." 1 Corinthians 3:11-15. Paul taught that, like the three little pigs, every Christian is building something with their life. The only question is, what kind of materials are you using? It makes a big difference whether you're building with gold or straw. For context, in the ancient world, fires were a serious threat. They didn't have the firefighting systems that we have today. If one house caught fire, it could spread quickly until the whole city was in flames. Cheaply made houses were most at risk of being burned up. Similarly, at the judgment seat of Christ, the Lord Jesus will evaluate all of your works, and you'll be rewarded according to what survives the fires of his judgment. Unfaithful believers will have their worthless works burned up like so much wood, hay, and stubble, and instead of being rewarded, they'll experience loss. Meanwhile, faithful believers who use fire-resistant materials, the equivalent of gold, silver, and jewels, will be rewarded by God. Their experience in eternity will somehow differ from that of believers who wasted their lives. Some commentators interpret the nature of these rewards literally, while others understand them figuratively. Whoever is right, those rewards will make a difference to the experience of the faithful servant. But notice Paul's last statement. Even if someone has lived such a worthless life that all their works are burned away, he will still be saved, though as through fire. Again, under grace, salvation is given as a gift apart from the works to do. Since you can't earn it by being good, you can't lose it by being bad. The only issue in salvation is whether or not you believe, not how consistently you have put that faith into practice. Let me add a final thought. Since the good works we do come from Christ living in us, John 15:5 and Galatians 2:20, and the Holy Spirit empowering us, Galatians 5:22-23 and Romans 8:9-11, even though the rewards are based on what we do, I think there's a large measure of grace in them too. Section 4.9, not a salvation issue. Unfortunately, throughout the centuries, Christians have often been taught that going to heaven or hell depends on what you do, including what you do with your wallet. Confusion about money and salvation can be traced to a misreading of a few key texts, including this warning to Timothy, quote, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out. If we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation, a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, and by craving it, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." End quote, 1 Timothy 6:6-10. Paul warned that fixating on getting rich caused some Christians to wander from the faith and even come to grief. Did Paul mean you could lose your salvation if you mishandled your money? Historically, many Christians have interpreted Paul that way. But if salvation is by faith apart from works, and it is, that couldn't happen. The moment you believed you were born again, passed from death to life, and Jesus promised never to cast you out, John 6:37. However, an eternally secure person can still sin. He can develop the wrong heart attitude towards money, wander into error and immorality due to greed, and suffer the consequences. Well, which consequences? Money is no guarantee of happiness. 7 out of 10 of the wealthiest men in the world are divorced. Like any sin, the love of money can lead to negative earthly consequences. Generally speaking, the sin of greed will make you miserable. As Paul said, you'll be pierced with grief, a Greek word meaning intense anxiety, anguish, grief, emotional pain. The love of money is a harmful desire that, if acted upon, can ruin your earthly life. Think of all the harm caused to marriages, families, careers, and reputations by foolish get-rich-quick schemes. It can also lead to dire spiritual consequences. As Paul said, you could wander from the faith. To use Jesus' language, love of riches can choke away your fruitfulness. And if you don't produce mature fruit, you won't be rewarded. And that will mean at least some grief at the judgment seat of Christ. So, what is the right attitude to have towards money? Instead of loving it so much that you keep wanting more, Paul says to be content with what you have. Godliness with contentment is great gain. How is contentment gain? An old Amish proverb explains it well. You're only poor when you want more than you have. That redefines what it means to be rich, doesn't it? If you become content with what you have, you've gained the wealth you didn't realize was already yours. In sum, the love of money can lead to serious negative earthly and spiritual consequences, but not to the loss of salvation. You should take those dangers seriously, but without compromising the gospel. Section 4.10, Conclusion. Grace giving is based on the motivations of your heart. Hence, it's important to have the right heart attitudes towards finances. Believers should be on guard against greed and the love of money. Instead of setting our hearts on earthly treasure, we should set them on heavenly treasure. Instead of being an idol we serve, it should be a tool we use to serve the Lord.